deliver your fire safety plan training. About a year ago, we were asked to write the fire safety plan for this facility. So we've really seen the building go up from the ground. And we were told we were going to be writing a fire safety plan for a very unique facility. It was to have fireplaces, squash court, hardwood floors, spiral staircase. And so I thought at first, yeah, I'll build a hotel. But that's not the case. It is a very unique building, and in my mind, a very eye-catching building, especially with the facade that faces Herb Street. You know, that black wall, you either hate it or you love it. And I'm one who loves it. I think it gives the building a sort of an air of complexity. I think it's quite unique. Now, how it's going to do in the summer with the heat bearing on it, I don't quite know, but I'm sure Peter is going to be involved in figuring that one out. Now, despite the stunning architecture of the building and all the features, it is basically a four-story office building. And as such, it contains features like a standpipe system, which is your hose cabinet, and the piping that supplies your hose cabinets on every floor. Also, your sprinkler system contains a single-stage fire alarm system with pull stations. An elevator, and all the basic features of a high-rise office tower. Now, because of the occupancy and the type of building it is, you are required by the Ontario Fire Code to have a fire safety plan. The production of the plan is only one part of the requirements of to meet those standards of the Ontario Fire Code. Your fire safety plan, the training involved in the fire safety plan, the inspections of your fire alarm system, your yearly inspections, and of course fire drills. So what Kevin and I are here for this morning is to deliver an information/training session and to equip you to provide training for your staff down the road, because you'll need to do fire drills. So we're going to give you some resources to equip you to do that. Okay, we're not here to conduct fire drills, but we're just here to give you the information you need to do that. So I'll just run through briefly what this presentation is going to entail. After a brief introduction of Kevin and myself, we'll go into what is called supervisory staff training, and you are designated supervisory staff who will take control and who will deliver instruction during a fire alarm or an actual fire. So we'll go through what is in a fire safety plan, where you find it, so what are your obligations, duties, specific duties, who does what. And then we'll deliver a little piece on fire drills. And to wrap it up, Kevin is going to give you a little bit of information on fireplace safe. Normally this is a topic that you cover in a residence, but because you have it here, and that's quite unique, he'll be talking a bit about that. We'll be showing a couple of videos. One is called No Time to Spare, and this is an actual reproduction of a fire, an actual fire in a home. And this is shown early on in the presentation just to drive home the point of how important prevention, detection, and escape is in a fire situation. We'll show you a couple of floor plans that are from your actual fire safety plan. We'll have another video on high-rise evacuation, so that's more pertinent to this facility. We'll go through the specific duties. And then Kevin will talk a bit about fire drills and a little bit about fire safety, and then we'll be done. Hopefully you'll wake up by then. No, it's not going to be that dry. I promise, no formula. You know, I did take calculus in high school, so I could dazzle you with a few derivatives and a bit of calculus, but I'm not going to go there. I'm a little rusty in that. So, let's get started then with our fire and safety plan presentation. Kevin Schmalz. Kevin was the gentleman who was primarily credited with your floor plans. These are done in an AutoCAD format, so they're quite nice looking and quite detailed and give you a lot of information about your building. The floor plans, although they're helpful for occupants, they're primarily for the fire department. They use these for their, it's called staging and pre-incident staging.
It's self-staging, tactical information operations.
So they're very helpful for the fire department. Now, the city of Kitchener, who I work for, their fire department is eventually planning to get computers in their trucks so that they can pull up a floor plan. So when they're on route to the scene, they can actually look at the building and pre-plan what they're going to do. So Kevin's got a lot of background in fire safety plans, in the whole aspect of prevention, detection, escape. You can see he's got various certificates. He's been a firefighter for over 19 years and is still an active firefighter. He's gone to the Ontario Fire College for prevention and protection. Municipal engineering technologist. He's a former plans examiner, inspector, and fire prevention officer. He's taken AutoCAD at Conestoga College. And believe me, I've taken the introductory course. And man, AutoCAD is something else. I don't know who here has AutoCAD experience, but it's quite a complex program. So I really appreciated his assistance with this fire safety plan. And he's been on various committees, as you can see. So I'm glad to welcome my colleague. Myself, I'm the emergency preparedness facilitator for the city of Kitchener, and I've been doing that for 2.5 years. What this entails is I write fire safety plans for the city. I've written fire safety plans for City Hall. There was an old plan, but I redid it. Waterloo Regional Children's Museum, various community centers, the new Kitchener Market, all kinds of fire safety plans. I also write and train in emergency procedures for facility staff. I have a Bachelor of Science from the University of Guelph in biology. And once when I was delivering a training session, a guy said, well, how are you using that and what you're doing? And I said, well, you know, I guess the only way I'm using it is I work with Homo sapiens. And he said, wait a minute, I'm not a Homo sapien. And I said, well, you know, he does resemble a primate. I don't know what genus though. And I'm a third class stationary engineer. So that's a bit about our background. So let's get into the meat of fire safety plan training. We'll go through these topics. What is a fire safety plan? What's in it? Who needs it? Where do I find it? What do I need to know? Who does what? And fire drills. Feel free to ask questions as we go along. There will be an opportunity after each session when we switch off to ask questions. So I would ask that you hold until those points, but feel free to ask questions. You may find that as we go along, your questions will be answered. A fire safety plan is a legal document required under Section 2.8 of the Ontario Fire Code. And this is the Ontario Fire Code right here. I don't know if you have one in the building, but it's quite a good document to have. Section 2.8 says supervisory staff shall be instructed in the fire emergency procedures as described in the fire safety plan before they are given any responsibility for fire safety. And then it goes on about supervisory staff, the measures in a fire safety plan. So that's a really good document. I think it's about $100 or so.
Yeah, pretty close to that.
Yeah.
The other aspect of the fire code is it's now available online through the fire marshal's website. So pretty quick and easy and cheap to reference information.
And that is a free program that you can access online? Okay, so before we get into specific duties and things of that nature, let's take a look at this video. No time to spare.
I'll just give you a little intro to it. Albert gave you a quick kind of idea of it, but this is a very special video that we use quite often to drive home message of fire safety, and in particular, here we are in the work environment, and there's a lot of provisions here for us and our safety with the firearm system, the sprinklers, the way things have been built, exits, so on and so forth. But the other part I want to drive home with you today is where we live at our homes, and that's equally or more important. This video will sure demonstrate how important it is to take it seriously and to make sure that days like today that you take something from this and use it at home as well. It's no time to spare, and it's from a 2001 fatal fire that occurred in a semi-detached home somewhere in Ontario, and they claimed the life of a five-year-old boy. And following the investigation, the fire marshal's office had the opportunity to recreate this fire and actually videotape it and put heat sensors in and so on. And essentially what they did was they took the other half of the semi-detached building and recreated the furnishings, the whole environment that was part and parcel of that family's home prior to the fire. And based on the witness reports and everything that they were able to find in their investigation, recreated the fire, and we'll see exactly what took place. And probably right after the video, I'll entertain a few questions or comments.
Ontario has an exceptional fire service, but fire and smoke can travel so quickly that despite your best efforts, firefighters may not be able to rescue you or your family. In fact, most fire fatalities occur when the fire department response time is 5 minutes or less. What you're about to see is the actual recreation of a fire that occurred in a home early one morning, even though the firefighters arrived within 3 minutes of receiving the call. The fire claimed the life of a five-year-old boy. This tragedy devastated the family, friends, firefighters, and the community. What we've learned from this recreation, we'd like to share with you. It could save your life or the lives of your loved ones. This reenactment clearly demonstrates how little time you may have to escape a fire in your home. It drives home a very important message. You must take responsibility for your own fire safety. To be safe in your home, you have to address three very important factors. They are fire prevention, detection, and escape. Prevention. There are simple precautions you must take to prevent fire from occurring in your home. Fire and smoke can spread so quickly, you and your loved ones may not have a chance. Detection. Install working smoke alarms at every level of your home and outside all sleeping areas. Escape. make sure everyone knows what to do when the smoke alarm sounds. Most fatal fires occur at night and everyone is asleep. As you will see, you may have less than 1 minute to safely escape.
During our investigation of the fatal fire, we determined the movements of the family based upon witness interviews. We also considered the amount of time it would take for them to exit the dwelling. The building consisted of two semi-detached homes divided by a cinder block wall. Other than some very minor smoke damage, the adjoining home was intact. Permission to burn the adjoining home provided us with a unique opportunity to recreate this fire in almost identical conditions. We prepared the adjoining home to ensure the furnishings, temperature, and conditions reflected those in the destroyed home. We then set up a fire simulation to test our theory that the fire that started in the wicker chair led to this tragedy. But more importantly, it provided an opportunity to test the effectiveness of smoke alarms and the importance of home escape planning. In the destroyed home, there was only one smoke alarm located in the hall outside the sleeping area on the second floor. For our reenactment, we installed smoke alarms on both the ground floor and the second floor. We believe the mother and the three-year-old came down the stairs, followed by the father and the five-year-old. It's quite likely that the boy became afraid of the fire and ran back upstairs. It is not uncommon for a child to react that way, which reinforces the need to hold on to your children and to assist them out of the home. We estimate it took 30 seconds for the family to escape the dwelling after the activation of the second floor smoke alarm. That's a critical moment, because when the family exited the dwelling and opened the door stayed open and provided oxygen to the dwelling fire. What you are seeing now is the alcove area in the living room of the simulation home. The kitchen is on the right side of the frame and the front door is on the left. A fire is being ignited on the wicker chair, which was determined to be the point of origin of the fire. The equipment hanging from the ceiling are the heat sensors installed to monitor the temperature of the room at various levels. The smoke is now pouring from the ignition point and a small flame is developing. The wicker chair is now burning. Ground floor smoke alarm activates. Remember, there was no ground floor smoke alarm in the actual fire. The fire is still in its early stages, but you can see that the smoke layers are already beginning to accumulate at the ceiling level. If the occupants were alerted to the fire at this point, they would have had more time to safely escape. In a fire, every second counts. The smoke alarm on the second floor now activates. This is the alarm the family heard. At this stage, they are getting out of bed, gathering their children, preparing to escape. These are the fire conditions that the family would have faced as they came down the stairs. At this point, the temperature in the room at shoulder levels is approximately 40 degrees Celsius. Watch closely what happens to the fire conditions when the front door opens and more oxygen is introduced into the room. At this stage, we believe the mother and child are now exiting the front door. In the confusion of the growing fire, the father and son became separated, and the father barely escaped with his life. Unfortunately, the child had run back up the stairs and perished in the fire. Within 30 seconds of the door opening, the temperature on the first and second floor soared to over 700 degrees Celsius. The fire is spreading rapidly throughout the room as flaming paint is dropping onto the furnishings. The room is rapidly approaching its peak temperature of 900 degrees Celsius. All of the materials in the room are burning, and in less than 3 minutes, we have now reached flashover conditions. No one could possibly survive these conditions. You can hear the front window shattering. These are the conditions that the firefighters faced as they entered the burning building in an attempt to rescue the young victim. Investigators from the Office of the Fire Marshal face these types of circumstances on a daily basis. The investigation of any fire fatality is never routine. However, the circumstances involving the death of a child are always tragic. What you have witnessed on the video continues, and as I speak, our investigators are investigating the fatalities of two young children in this house fire. You need to do everything you can do to stop me from coming to your home.
This reenactment taught us a lot. We hope that you've learned the three things that can protect you and your loved ones from fire. They are prevention, detection, and escape. Prevention. This fire clearly shows that you cannot risk having a fire in your home. By far, the majority of home fires are preventable. Adults and children are dying in fires that can easily be avoided. There are simple things we can do to ensure that fire never starts in our homes. Make sure that matches and lighters are kept out of sight and reach for children, preferably locked away. If you smoke, keep only one lighter, a book of matches, with you. That way, you will know if they are missing. Supervise your children. Blow out all candles before leaving the room or going to bed. Watch anyone who smokes in your home and anyone who drinks excessively, then attempts to smoke or cook. Excessive drinking often contributes to fatal fires. Detection. If, after our best efforts, a fire starts in our home, we want to know about it right away. Therefore, one smoke alarm in the home is not enough. Every home needs at least one alarm on every level of the home and outside all sleeping areas. Early warning of a fire can give you and your family the freshest seconds you need to safely escape. Escape. Everyone in the home needs to know what to do when the smoke alarm sounds. Most fatal fires occur at night when everyone is asleep. If the smoke alarm sounded in your home tonight and there was a fire, are you sure that everyone would get out safely? Does everyone know the plan? Are there two ways out of all areas? Take the time now to discuss it with those you live with. Who will assist the small children or older adults at home? As you saw in this fire, a fast, pre-planned escape was critical to survival. There were no second chances. The Fire Service of Ontario is working hard to keep our community safe from fire, but we can't do it alone. We need your help. Remember, prevention, detection, and escape. It's your responsibility to keep your home safe from fire. Approximately 100 people die in fires in Ontario each year. Many are children. This is unacceptable. Please help us stop these needless tragedies.
Your favorite sofa, your jewelry, your clothes, your goldfish, your photographs, your children. Think of all you could lose in fire, then burn this into your mind. You have the power to prevent it. Blow out all candles before leaving the room or going to bed. Don't leave matches or lighters lying around. Supervise your children and always drink responsibly. A message from the Fire Marshal and Smart Risk. When your smoke alarm goes off, you know just what to do. You've seen it a million times in movies. You gather up your precious photos and your favorite clothing, waltz down the stairs through a blazing fire to call the fire department and save the day. But this isn't a movie set. This is a real house that burned down, and it took less than 2.5 minutes. No time to pack, no time to call. When you hear your smoke alarm, get out right away. Have an alarm on every level of your home and test them monthly to make sure they work. A message from the Fire Marshal and Smart Risk. We actually burned this house down in real time to show you that you have less than 3 minutes.
So, I think, you know, we can all basically agree that, number one, it's a pretty powerful video. It demonstrates real life, real time, real conditions, real smoke, real flames. And you can see from the point that that fire started, how rapidly it grows, gets totally out of control. And that's part of the reason we're here. It's the people are responsible for this building, respect to fire, and ensuring that if fire does occur here, that planning is taken seriously and everybody knows what they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to do it. We make sure that everybody that's in the building gets out. We can replace the building, but we can't replace them. Three things that were discussed. Anybody remember what they were?
Yeah. Detection and safety.
Yeah. And when you consider those three elements, certainly prevention. We can ensure that we take part of that and apply that. Detection. Well, we've got a facility or we've got our homes that have detection devices. The key is, particularly at home, to make sure that that smoke alarm, yeah, it's up there, you see it, but it's working. All too often, I've been into homes and buildings where there have been fires, and it's there, it's melted. No battery or battery has been changed, and now we have a fatality or injury or huge excessive damage because of that detection device was there, but wasn't maintained in an operating condition. So when you go home, try to remember, if you haven't already done so, to check your smoke alarms. Some of them may be hardwired in. There's power outages. Well, that detector's likely not going to work unless it has a battery backup or you have another smoke alarm that has a battery in it. So remember those things. Remember what we recommend is when time changes, spring and fall, that's the time to some people leave it once a year, go away on vacation for a week, and that battery gets that little beep when it's getting weak, it needs to be replaced, so people think, oh, it's good then, but if you're away on vacation, when this thing's chirping away, and you come back, that battery is toast, and you're assuming that everything's hunky dory. So it's good to get into that habit. Is there any questions with respect to the video? We saw the intensity of the fire, the temperatures, way beyond livable, and essentially that room flashed over, which meaning a flashover is that all the contents in that room, including people, if there was firefighters in there with the protective gear on, that's how we get killed, flashovers. Mainly because all our protective gear, our helmets, everything reaches that ignition temperature and we become part of the fire. So you can see how that detection and making sure that for sure someone has called us. Forget which year it was. About 10 years ago, we had a fatal house fire, which probably a lot of you remember, in Kitchener, where five kids were killed. The mother escaped. She was obviously frantic. The door was left open. So what happens when doors are left open, that's why. When fire inspectors come walking through the building, they see a door that's in a fire separation. It's been wedged open, especially in high-rise apartment buildings and things like that. The first thing they do is they grab that ledge and put it in their pocket. That door is there to prevent the spread of fire and to contain it and ensure that it's doing the job that it's doing. So, you know, the doors that are here that are in specific areas, particularly mechanical rooms and things like that, sometimes you're moving equipment or things in and out. That's fine. You're basically there, and you're going to be able to identify if there's a problem related to fire pretty quickly. But if you're heading off to have a coffee break, doesn't hurt to close that door. Just make sure. Any questions whatsoever on the video or? What'd you think of the video? You hit home or?
It's home,
yeah.
It's
exactly. It's, you know, we see Hollywood, right? We see the fires on TV and our soap boxes or movies and things, and obviously you don't see real fire. You see controlled fire. It's obviously set up by natural gas or some sort of flaming device that has the appearance of fire. But if you notice with those Hollywood movies, where's the smoke? I mean, within what, a minute and a half, 2 minutes, you could see three quarters of that room. Smoke gets, it's extremely black, toxic, hot, and it hits at the ceiling level and keeps working its way down. That's another thing to remember is if you ever are in that situation, that's what we do as firefighters. That's what we're trained to do is we get down low and crawl in. Because the air down below is hundreds of degrees cooler. And you know, your survival down. That's why with the programs we teach kids, you know, it's when they're practicing their escape plans and things like that, get down and crawl. Again, the temperature, the toxic levels. You may find that you know, you may be able to run out quicker. But one gasp of some of this toxic smoke, not only because it's toxic, but the temperature basically just sears your lungs, and that's it. If you survive, you've suffered smoke inhalation, and it's questionable whether you're gonna end up surviving in the long run or not. Your lungs and your throat, this is sustained steady heat damage.
If I can add a little piece here, Kevin, a couple of years ago we had a fire at City Hall. Somebody lit a trash can on fire, and Kevin's right, the smoke was the biggest problem. As soon as the detectors caught the smoke, the fans shut down. That's just a building code requirement. So the fans shut down. Firefighters had an awful time getting rid of that smoke. And before my time, about a year before I got to City Hall, there was a car fire on one of the garage levels. We have two garage levels. And the smoke from that was unbelievable. It was pouring out of the exit. And what they found, too, was under the security desk, which is on the ground floor in the rotunda. I don't know if you've ever been to Kitchener City Hall, but the smoke was coming up through conduit openings that hadn't been fire-stopped properly when the building was put up. So the fire was migrating up to the ground floor as well. And smoke, I believe, in an office fire is probably the number one concern because it's toxic. You've got furnishings that give off toxic fumes. You've got carpeting. You would think in an office building, not much can burn, but yes, there's wood. Wallboard paper covering on that. You have hardwood floors here. Any number of things could combust. So I just thought I'd mention that.
So back to the fire safety plan, and we want to look at what exactly is in it. As you can see here, there's what's supposed to be in the plan, and we've ensured it is thus far, though it's up to you to ensure that if things change, that it's recognized in your plan. There's important building technical information, such as obviously the fire alarm system, your suppression systems, which again, including your sprinklers, your fire hose cabinets, even in your kitchen, there's an extinguishing system in there. Your computer hub room, there's a system in there. Your fire extinguishers. All those things are documented in the plan. There's information in there with respect to maintaining those things. One of the big things for us as firefighters, again, we talked earlier about pre-incident, and that's right on the title of the documents, pre-incident attack for firefighters. Great to have a bit of an idea of the layout of the building in advance, and you may or may not have already had fire crews that have come through touring the building, getting an idea of the layout ahead of time. So it's obviously much tougher under smoke and heat conditions to understand the building and so on. So if they have a good floor plan layout, it's fairly accurate and so on. Have an idea of where their hose cabinets are, stuff when they come in with their fire hose, where they can hook up. That's important. Obviously, fire exits. Mainly for the occupants of the building that are here ahead of time. Visitors.
If I can interject, Kevin, there are two stairwells here that are designated fire exits, and that's stair number one, the south stair, which exits onto, I believe, the covered parking lot. And then there's stair five, which I believe is called the north stair, and it exits out onto ground level on the far side of the building. Those are two designated fire stairs.
Firefighter access into the building, into the opposite parking lot. The main firefighter access point is the door is just off the parking lot. The fire truck will park almost directly in front of that, and that'll be their way in. The doors may be locked, so security or someone needs to ensure that they go to that door to meet the fire department to help them gain access. I believe you also have a thing called a lock box that the fire department has the only key to open that box. It's built right into the wall, and it's a very secure thing manufactured by companies that build safes. And inside that box, they, with their key, they open it up and they have access to master keys and things for the buildings. It always helps if somebody can meet them there and they don't have to do that. But in the event that nobody's here or preoccupied with checking something out, then for sure they can get in. Also an idea of the hazardous materials that may be on site and where they're stored. That kind of information. Personnel information. We need to have an idea of who are the people that are typically in this building. If there's specific times where, you know, the occupant load is higher, when it's lower,
those types of things. Who are the key people that we need to talk to when we arrive on scene, whether it be for a tour, whether it be for the actual fire prevention officer responsible for the building, or obviously we want to know who's in charge here, who can help us out if there is a fire that can help direct us. And Peter's obviously the number one choice with respect to the facility and all the mechanical components, etc. There's others that also have to fill in too. We need to understand the fire procedures, and that's all documented in there. The owner's responsibility, as Albert mentioned earlier with the fire code, the Fire Prevention Protection Act dictates by law what the owner is required to do. Part of it is the fire safety plan, making sure that the staff here understand their responsibilities. Ultimately, the owner is responsible for the building and all the fire aspects of the fire prevention, detection, so on and so forth. But as Peter's role and your roles, each of us has certain responsibilities. And we need to make sure we take them seriously and understand them. Fire system maintenance information, as I said earlier, is kind of a checklist in the back of the book that identifies all the components related to fire protection and provisions, including fire doors, things like that, and how often you're supposed to check them, yearly inspections that companies come in and they'll check your system. Those things are required by law. Fire drill, well, we all remember fire drills from when we were in school and kids, and that was always kind of a fun thing. You got to run out and leave school for a minute. And as we get older, obviously it's not something we would want to do much for concentrating on our work. And with fire drills, talk about that a little bit later, but perhaps a little different meaning and a different process with respect to a workplace environment. Hopefully our floor plan shows up here. Essentially with the floor plans, near the fire the fire exits themselves, near the elevator, you'll see diagrams that illustrate the building layout. They illustrate the exits, direction to an exit if one is blocked. Also identifies fire hose cabinets, extinguishers, those kind of things. With the fire safety plan diagrams, essentially what they illustrate to us is it's almost a pictorial audit of your building and the fire safety systems within it. So when the fire crews arrive on scene, they have this information readily available to them. If there's a mechanical room that the fire's in, okay, whereabouts is it? What kind of features are in there? Is it sprinkler? The fire plan will illustrate that room has a fire separation. It's got a rating built into the walls and the doors that will hold fire back for at least an hour or two. Here we've got the site plan, and of course it's a little bit blurry, but you can certainly make out the most of the features. Gives the responding fire crew an idea of course, location, where they can access into the parking lot. Still, kind of red and black arrows indicate the actual fire route that's designated. Again, I had indicated that when the fire trucks arrive, this is the entrance that they will use. That's noted on the plan. And it's that doorway that they access, and the fire alarm annunciator panel, which is a smaller panel, is located right in that vestibule, that hallway. And the main fire alarm panel, of course, is in the electrical just around the corner. It identifies to the firefighters that just beyond the back corner of the building is where the hookups are for the standpipe and sprinkler system. So when they arrive, what we end up doing is there's already water charged into the system. So again, you look at Hollywood and somebody wants to set off the sprinklers and they take a lighter and away it goes. Well, again, it's Hollywood, not too realistic. Shows off every sprinkler in the whole building going off. Reality, each sprinkler head, you'll see a little glass ball in there. Ball, and it's got liquid in there that it's basically made to expand at a certain temperature. Different liquids will expand at different temperatures. This one's a red one. I can't recall exactly what the temperature is, but at a certain temperature, that liquid will expand. Burst the bulb, and water will come out of that sprinkler, but only that one. It takes heat to break the next one and the next one. The other thing with the plan, we have an idea of where the fire hydrants are, because when we want to hook up to these systems, the fire department is actually going to hook up with the hydrant to the truck, the pump in the truck increases the pressure and pushes the water through the hose into the connections, and you get better pressure and so on. Particularly if the firefighters are coming in and now they're hooking up to the standpipe system, you'll have a certain amount of water pressure already in the system again, but to make our job more effective, especially if we're using one or two hand lines to attack the fire, then we'll need extra pressure, so boost the pressure up. It identifies the location of the fire department lockbox at that location. Indicates that there's an emergency generator where it's located in case power fails. Kicks in, provides emergency power to key components of the fire safety system. Your exit lights, some of the lighting in the building is on that standby power. So it gives them a bit of a snapshot. The other thing you see up the top there, it's called site staging plan. The reason it's staging is because there's more than one fire truck that comes. So it helps them to get an idea where they can stage their vehicle to park them and essentially be the most effective. Sometimes you jam it up too quickly and then your trucks are kind of locked in because another truck's behind it, and that's not where they want to essentially have it. They may want the ladder truck to pull up at a certain point, or the rescue truck, which has specialized equipment for the rescue and so on. That's your site plan. Then you also have floor plans. And because of the complexity and the size of this building, what we ended up doing was doing an overall floor plan for each floor. So the first floor, And then we took it and we actually broke it down into two lanes, just for the ability to have the features legible. So, without being able to read it, you can obviously see the layout of the building on this document here, which is the entire first floor plan. It's in color, which is kind of an added feature, helps to pick out things that you want information on. For instance, I mentioned some of the rooms that will have fire separations. They're highlighted here. You can see it there with the orange, and it indicates what type of fire resistance rating we have. So kind of the light orange is a 1 hour rating, and the ready color is a 2 hour separation. The green arrows obviously indicate directional exits, how to get out. We have features, for instance, the pull stations for by exit doors, so that make sure as you're leaving the building that if the fire alarm isn't already activated, you pull that so everybody else has that warning. Where your garbage is stored, the features in the electrical room, your sprinkler in the mechanical room identifies where the valves are and that type of thing, so that obviously when the sprinkler activates, we want to be able to shut that off because we've got things under control. So we obviously need to know where that room is and so on. Provides information, again, fire department's main entrance. This is your typical main entrance, but for the purpose of the firefighters, it's over here. Illustrates points of entry from the exterior so that if firefighters are on one side of the building or the other, they have a better understanding of how they're going to get in, or they can radio to the commander, we're entering a door at such and such a site. You can see the fire hydrant up here, our connections, and again, this particular plan is broken down into smaller sections to make it a little more legible. We have the legend that indicates all the features that are on this particular plan, so that you can reference that. And what else? Something that isn't readily visible here, but with the fire departments, there's kind of a an idea of how to orientate themselves with the building. And essentially, the street side of the building, which is here, because it's your address, Caroline Street. This building face is called E1, Exposure 1, and then it works in a clockwise progression. So essentially, this side of the building is E2, the back side is E3, and the side that the reflecting pool is on is E4. That way, when the firefighters radio for the commander, I'm entering the door on E4. Into the atrium area for you. That way the commander has this document, he knows specifically where that crew is going in, so if they become trapped or they need new equipment, etc., or he wants to send another crew in, he knows exactly where they are. So, who needs the fire safety plan? Obviously, I've indicated firefighters really need that information. The people that are responsible for the the supervisory staff that are responsible for carrying out the fire safety procedures, you need to understand that document and have a clear idea of what your responsibilities are. In the event Peter is not here or he needs assistance, how do your systems work? How do you reset the fire alarm system? Those kind of things. Obviously, the building owner through the fire code is ultimately responsible. So if things go wrong, fingers get pointed upstairs. If plan was not in place, if it wasn't prepared and this has already gone through and been reviewed and approved by the Waterloo Fire Prevention Office, if that wasn't in place, obviously they can come and lay charges, which is not something we like to do. We like to see the work get done. We like to see things obviously in place. So and sometimes it happens, we have landlords of buildings and so on, the fire code violations are laid and then nothing happens, then we go to court and there's big time fines and jail time involved if we don't follow through. So the owner is responsible, and of course the occupants, and again, if you have lectures like this one or other lectures in the main auditorium where there's other visitors, other guests here, and they may be actually wandering other areas of the building as well. We need to make sure that they have an idea of the layout of the building, how to get in and out. Where do I find the fire safety plan? There's two official copies. Each of those copies are stamped, dated, approved by the Waterloo Fire Prevention Office. One copy is left with them in their office. One copy, official copy, is kept here on site, probably stored away. And then there's additional copies of the plan available here on site. So you need to understand where it's kept. The thought is that, again, when the fire department arrives, they may or may not have that document with them. It also obviously helps when they do arrive. It may be a fire truck that doesn't normally respond here as their first call response, because they may be tied up in another incident, or they may be up at the training center, so another station is in to cut her off. So recognizing the fact that they're going to need your help. So where that copy of the plan is, and if you can produce that for the firefighters when they arrive. Obviously, for you to review it and understand that the whole plan itself is critical. I mentioned earlier that near the elevators and the exits, there's a kind of a simplified plan, escape plan that's located on the wall. Also with that is just a general, very simple escape procedures and procedure of what to do in the event of a fire. So you need to kind of review that and make sure you're up to speed with that. And what do I need to know? Fire safety plan contains fire alarm and fire emergency procedures and information for staff and occupants. It is important that you are familiar with these procedures, your duties in a fire emergency, and of course your evacuation route. Again, stressing the impact of that video and how quickly fire can spread, how quickly the smoke and elements of the fire migrate around the building. So as they said, prevention, make sure in advance you're prepared and follow those procedures.
We'll just switch microphones here.
Yep.
Is there any questions at all?
There's a test. Pretty exciting stuff, eh? Kind of dry, but Very important. This could save a life someday. So what I'd like to do is to get into specific duties now. I don't know if specific staff have been designated specific duties, not yet. Colleen's shaking her head. So when you review this afterward, you may want to, and it's also dependent on where you are in the building as to what positions you will take up. So that's what we'll do now, we'll go through each position and specific duties. There's a lot of information here, and you know, it's not expected that you remember the first time through, but it comes with practice, and of course, holding drills, and even not in a drill situation, but just to do dry runs, that type of thing, that always helps. Now, I would think the facility supervisor, correct me if I'm wrong, Colleen, it will probably be Peter Bernhardt, because he's the one with the intimate knowledge of the building, intimate knowledge of mechanical systems, and he's probably here a lot of the time. So your duties, Peter, or your alternate, if you were not here, you would leave the fire, and this is upon discovery of the fire. So we have two situations. We have on discovery of the fire, or we have upon a fire alarm. Upon a discovery of the fire, and this pertains to everybody, you leave the fire area immediately, taking persons in the immediate vicinity with you. It's important to close your doors on the way out, and Kevin alluded to that. If there is no fire alarm, well, assuming there is no fire alarm sound, you would pull a fire alarm at a pull station. Go to a safe area and dial 911. Now, this safe area will be an area away from smoke with access to a safe exit outside the building. Or you may call from outside the building. Now, the reason you would call 911 even after you've activated a pull station, because your system is connected to the fire department, so they're going to get a signal. Now, I've been told by the fire department that you call 911 because the signal may be delayed or it may not get to the fire department. For some reason, who knows? It's an electronic connection, those have been known to fail. So you would call 911 and just give them information about what you think is going on. And if you're pretty sure it's a child at the pull station, you need to let them know so that they can stand down. And I believe they always send two trucks. But if you call and say, we're pretty sure it's a false alarm, they'll stand down one vehicle and they'll send one. Is that correct, Kevin?
Most situations? That is correct. And each city kind of has a different response. There's probably at least three to four trucks that are involved in the initial response. Two pumper trucks. We provide that information, that false alarm. And three of those four trucks return to their station where they can respond to other trucks.
But they always show up. They'll never cancel the call. So the facility supervisor, after calling 911, should use the stairs to go to the main entrance, and that's the entrance where you're going to meet the fire department, and provide them with keys, with information about the building, where the main fire alarm panel is, and that type of thing. I need to stress that you should not use the elevators. In some buildings, the elevators recall to the ground floor anyways. I don't know if they do here. I don't think they do. But elevators can fail in a fire situation, so you don't want to be trapped in an elevator cab and have to elicit some type of extrication response there. So meet the fire department and relay information.
Incidentally, just back to calling the fire department, dialing 911. As I mentioned earlier, fatal fire with five children. That was a big part of the dilemma there. Was everybody assumed the fire department was all, but neighbors. Many of the neighbors were quite upset at us that why did you take so long to get here? Tapes on our dispatch that we didn't receive the call until something like 6 minutes later. Would we have been able to save all the children? Nobody knows. Certainly, you know, as soon as it happens, don't hesitate to call 911. Don't assume that it's been done. Here, you check with the responsible people to ensure that I'll email Peter, have you called 911? Yes, I have. But like Albert indicated, even if it's a false attempt, or even if it is a fire, the fire department is trying to go on to on route to get information from you so that we can let the firefighters have an idea of what's going on, where it's at. Talk about that staging plan, the site plan, to have a better idea. If you want to put a truck here, we want to automatically send a crew around this side or whatever. Very important.
Thanks, Kevin. Do you have to dial 9 to get an external number here? Okay, so you may want to put that in your literature, 9-911. That's important. What happens if someone would just dial 911? Do you know?
I don't think we'll go away. Although we can probably configure it to do that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe something you want to consider. Yeah. But until that time, there should be that 9911.
Albert?
Yes?
There's also a standard phone app reception desk besides security.
And that's just a normal. Direct line note? Yeah. Okay. That's good to know. All right. Yes, Peter?
When you call 911, are you connected right to the fire department dispatch when you say you have a fire, or do they relay the information?
It's a good question. What happens is there's a 911 dispatcher, and that's all they handle. It's the actual 911. And that's located at the police headquarters on Maple Road. And what happens then, they ask the police, fire, or a medic, which is an emergency. Of course, they want to know what city you're from. And essentially, they'll dispatch to fire dispatch, police dispatch, or ambulance. And so Kitchener actually, Kitchener's dispatch actually does the service for Waterloo and 11 counties. So you'd be talking first to the 911 and then secondarily to our fire dispatch. In our communications.
And when the fire alarm goes off and the signal goes to the alarm monitoring company, do they transmit it electronically to the fire department or to the 911 dispatch, or where does it go?
It depends where the call center is. Some of the companies, it's down in St. Louis or something. Mm-hmm. Some connection has to go to St. Louis and then send it back up. But it's essentially not a phone line. It doesn't mean a phone line. Call back is.
Do they just transmit an electronic signal, or do they transmit information?
It's verbally.
But verbally, not
through the designated phone line and information.
Those are good questions. Facility supervisor duties on hearing a fire alarm would be to dial 911 and advise the fire department of the emergency. You would go to the main entrance and check the annunciator for the location of the alarm, if it is safe to do so. Always remember that you are to maintain your own safety. Again, don't use the elevators, and meet the fire department and relay information. Fire warden. Fire wardens are essentially the people who take care of staff or occupants and help them get out. On discovery of the fire, you would leave the fire area immediately, again taking persons in the immediate vicinity with you, closing all doors on your way out, sound a fire alarm by pulling a pulse station, and again, go to a safe area and dial 9911. And again, this is an area away from smoke with ready, with access to the outside of the building. After that, you exit the building without using the elevators, and you would have an assembly area, a designated assembly area, where you would account for people in your section. Any questions on that?
I don't know if you'll cover it yet, or if you're going to cover it later in the following, but you have a significant number of visitors that come through this building, and so it's going to be really difficult to know at any one time.
That's a good question.
It's not impossible.
Sure.
So when you say if they account for all occupants, that's a really difficult one to do. I mean, I don't know, from a legal standpoint, what it is we have to do to try and, you know, at least present visitors with this information, et cetera. Like, we can't keep tabs on it. My take on it. And, you know, I think all commands the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I don't know if you're
to sort of
present that or to try and handle that as best we can.
Yeah, and you do what's reasonable, what you're able to do that's reasonable. As long as you're able to show evidence of that, then any court is not able to hold you liable.
Sure.
If there are, and that's common with any kind of building where the public arrives, but if you have something going on in the auditorium, there's a couple things you can do. You can have people sign in. That's not always possible, but head count, kind of a basic idea, also, you know, gives you a record of, for this particular lecture, we had 82 people. Just a few simple things like that, and typically, even at our headquarters fire station, any guests that are in the building, whether city staff or not, other than the on-duty personnel and the office staff there, anyone that's not normally part of that facility. Our IT people come and they come and work on a computer or electricians are there, whatever. Everyone who signs in, signs out. That can be a bit onerous, but if you're able to do it, the way you can manage it.
The problem with us is, in our research staff, we don't have regular hours, so we don't have to get them to sign in all the time, which I don't think we're going to like very
much. Exactly. And that's...
It's not a 9-5 job.
Precisely. And that's why some of these procedures are also important to follow, so that as the fire warden or whatever, and each of these researchers obviously have to understand, you know, that somebody has to check that for.
So how many wardens can you recommend that we have in this building?
At City Hall, we have 3 per floor. Mm-hmm. Ideally, if this helps cover for vacations, sickness, that type of thing. And it's through training and it's through drills that people become familiar with the procedure and a way to avoid complacency. Because that's one of the main problems with fire alarms is complacency. And I know early on you had quite a few number of fire alarms when they were getting the system going. And people think, oh, that's just a false alarm, I'm going to stick around. And that's where the fire wardens come in. I mean, your duty is to go around these areas in your immediate vicinity and get these people out. If you notice a researcher that came in the morning, they don't happen to be in their office, you may want to check a washer. Check the areas in your vicinity. I guess accounting for occupants, it may be too specific a word, but if you have full-time staff who you know were there in the morning and you exit the building, you don't see them. You need to let the fire department know right away that they didn't get out. So in a way, you're accounting for them that way, for visitors, and you get lots of visitors for lectures and things like that. Just make sure that they follow your instructions and get them out. The last warden out of the area should do a sweep. Check the area, make sure it's clear.
So in the event of a fire, and you have three wardens, each of those wardens is supposed to be doing a certain thing, or are they expecting enough the one that's in charge? And then one warden for the Lord is put in charge, or do they all have an assigned area?
They should have an assigned area, and what we use at City Hall is called a floor procedure. So those three wardens should get together and maybe write on paper. We also have a form that says, number one warden, this is what you do. Number two warden, this is what you do. Number three, who has first aid capability? Where is our assembly area? So you may have people on that side of the building exit stair five and go to, I think that's west.
So is that part of the plan that you did, like did you sort of designate your people from parts of the building below?
No.
That's something we have to
arrange, that's
you
right.
You have form that they give us?
I can email you the forms, yeah. And then you
and
can...
And by law, how many ones do we have to have?
I don't think there is a law. I don't think so, but there have to be supervisory staff in the building.
And when you say supervisory staff, in regards to this, it's whoever being assigned to the supervisory staff
for right.
this purpose.
That's right. Right.
Because basically all these people, I mean, they're not all supervisory people, but for our purposes, these people are here in the building most of the time every day. Mm-hmm. So that's why we want them here. And not the researchers. I mean, the researchers come and go, and there's no way we can be sure that they're here. So these are the people that we would want to be wardens and have to be wardens. So it doesn't matter whether they're supervisory staff,
that's
supervisory
right.
people, supervisory.
That's right. And that's where that term comes in. I didn't want to connote that it was your administrative supervisory staff, but it's the fire supervisory staff. So if you take a supervisory role during an alarm or a fire.
So something we can do after this is just designate who is.
Exactly.
I think you can back out of the community staff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think it should probably be full time. It's kind of like the fourth floor, maybe Russell and Dan, there's pretty much a second floor, third floor IT, and then there's more people available the second, and then whoever's more member and the first, and then weekdays would be covered.
And you may have times where there's one staff in the building, that may be security. And if you have a PA system, if you don't have a PA system. Okay. And typically, how many researchers are here after hours? Could it be any number?
Any number. Mm-hmm. And I think at night, we'll probably have a better system. We should actually have a sign-in system because there's only one real supervisory person for this. If you do the security guy, then they should know that. So, I mean, if we have night, I mean, there's no other staff, paid for staff, so our security person is the only one that we can sort of train this, so he'd be responsible for the building.
That's
we never know who else would be here, so he'd be responsible.
And that stresses the need to conduct after-hours drills as well. And make sure your occupants know that they are to go out. Let them know the sound of the fire tone. I don't know if they've all heard it. They have right. So if they hear that fire tone, they should instinctively know that they need to leave. I hesitate, well, I can say that no fire plan is going to be perfect, but if you practice due diligence, then you're going to be covered. But that's not the aim, to cover yourselves. The aim is to get people out. Sorry, to go back there. On hearing a fire alarm, immediately direct all occupants to leave the building by the nearest exit. where possible, check all rooms before leaving, just to make sure everybody's out. Where possible, check that all the fire doors are closed at the next building. Go to your assembly area. And again, avoid use of the elevators.
Just something I want to touch on there too is we're kind of looking at this point is checking these rooms to ensure that the occupants are vacated that space. The other element is discovery of fire. And part of our training as firefighters, some little tips here that help save your life. Actually, discovery of fire. It's that if there are signs of fire, a little bit of smoke popping from the door, underneath the door, you may not want to open that door. You've already got the signs there. If you open the door, you may have seen a movie a number of years back, a Hollywood type thing called Backdraft. And again, all the Hollywood effects. But Backdraft is essentially where you open a door into a room where fire has been building for a period of time, and it actually gets to a point that it's consumed a substantial amount of the fresh oxygen that needs to burn. That oxygen level, there's still oxygen, but it's at a reduced level. So the fire is still burning, but it's at a much slower burn, and it's now actually really, really intense high heat. Very little flame. The smoke and toxic gases, a lot of that, those gases are unburned gases as well. And as soon as you open that door, you can introduce all this oxygen, nice and fresh stuff. And just that part of the movie was pretty factual. The Backdraft, it's like a huge explosion that comes right out the door, and you're cooking. So if you note that there is signs of fire, don't open the door. If you're not sure, but you're suspecting the likelihood that there is fire, again, don't open the door. Go up to the door. Don't open it. Don't touch the handle. But using the back of your hand, feel the door. And that way, if it's hot, you're going to feel it. It burned your hand. But also by using the back part of your hand, you can still use your hand to open the door and get yourself out. So just prepare.
Thanks, Kevin. So those are the fire warden duties in a nutshell. Now we have someone called an exit supervisor. This person takes essentially the same action by leaving the fire area immediately, taking occupants, closing doors on your way out, sounding the fire alarm, going to a safe area, dialing 911, exiting the building, and then going to a designated exit, if it's safe to do so. This is just to prevent people from going back into the building. If you're on activation of your fire alarm, does your security system lock? Your doors lock? From the outside? No. Okay, at City Hall, our stairwells lock, except floor 5 and 10, near crossover floor, because it's a high building, it's over 6 stories high. But you may want to check that out. If your exterior door is locked, sometimes there's a fire alarm relay that drops power to your security system and locks the door just for security reasons.
Our connections during the fire alarm are being stopped hitting the air conditioning system so it doesn't spread smoke, and then it goes into a smoke evacuation mode, which are separate fans. I don't believe there's a connection to the fire alarm other than the fence. And it's security that way, as you
we've not been told that that's the way it is.
Okay. So it just stresses the need that if you want to, keep people safe and protect the building, just have someone stationed at the exterior doors. You know, it's been done before where someone's pulled a full station and just waltzed into a building and carried off, whatever. So just keep that in mind. On hearing a fire alarm, the exit supervisor should go to your designated exit that's safe. Don't use the elevators. Assure the occupants do not re-enter the building until authorized by the chief fire official. Remain at your position if safe to do so, and then wait for the all clear. You'll have people wanting to go back in before the all clear is given. That's a common thing at City Hall. I've seen that as well. So it's important to keep people going back in. Questions? Yes.
Because of the speed in the building, we had maybe like false fire alarms go off, trouble enough. So I'm wondering, how do you get people then to start thinking, it's just another false fire alarm? I'm not going to go in
there. I don't know.
Is there anything that,
It's a tough one because it's just human nature to become complacent.
Do you think what we'll have to do is have a Peter and I have to have both to do this scientifically and stress on this because it actually happened. We did have a real final alarm, and he tried to, without really knowing he was doing a lot, a few of us met in the main arms. I said, I'll go here, we did it quite well, really. But we went through the building, we all had our assigned floors, and there were people right from the top floors, and hello, either the alarm, and he said,
you thought it would be false one. So what we'll have to do is after we establish the fire alarm, we'll make sure that we're driving home. Right, and those are good points, Colleen. The advantage we have at City Hall is we have a two-stage fire alarm system. The first stage is a slow bomb, so people can gather in areas. They don't have to leave the building, but they gather, and then if it goes to a second stage, which is a fast bomb, then they would. But you have a single stage system, and that's what was put in. Unfortunately, you have to leave because it's an evacuation drill right off the start. This will help. This high-rise evacuation video will really help. I believe it's also a two-stage system in that building, but it gives you an idea of different roles to play in the fire alarm. And you may want to buy high visibility armbands for your fire supervisory staff because it gives you a bit of an air of authority and every bit helps. Okay.
While Albert's queuing up the movie, just might suggest that if you want to stretch and grab the freshman at the back.
Okay, this video is about 17 minutes long, so after that, I don't think there's much.
Can we have like 5 minute break?
Sure, sure. Yep.
I don't know. How would you make this?